Just before we get started, the Second Act Podcast would like to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on Treaty 7 land inhabited by the Blackfoot Nations. This includes the Siksika, Piikani, and Kainai. We would also like to acknowledge the Tsuut'ina and Stoney Nakoda First Nations, as well as the Métis Nations and all people who make their home on Treaty 7 land in southern Alberta. But now that we've paid respects to people that were here before us, let's start the pod.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, the Second Act Podcast, and today's guest is Frank King.
Frank came to us through one of the podcast guest services websites that I subscribe to, and he had so much material about him on the internet, the mental health comedian. The more I read, the more I watched, the more I couldn't believe that this guy's story was just out there for the telling.
Yeah, and the thing that impresses me the most about these pods that have these heavier tones is just the ability of these people to admit that they are not well and help. It's hard to admit that you aren't feeling the best in a math class, let alone feeling like you're going to kill yourself. And it's just, it's so impressive how strong these people are to not only admit that they aren't feeling well, but do something about it.
That was the part that got me as well. When he said a couple of years earlier, his car broke down and he had three thoughts. I could fix it, I could buy a new car, or I could kill myself. He's like, when you have the kind of mentality that he's been blessed with, he calls it his blessing and his curse, his sense of humor and then the chronic suicidal thoughts. He's like, suicide's always on the menu. It's always a solution to whatever problem could be coming up. And to hear him speak so frankly about it, it's an incredible podcast. I think Frank is, you know, his ability to kind of level things out, take it to something funny, which is, you know, most people have that kind of barometer, and talk about things that are important, things that are serious, and lend a voice to people who may not know how to talk about those things. It's just an incredible ability, and He's an incredible conversation. So please, without any further ado, welcome Frank King.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. I'm a big fan of Canadians. I did my ninth TEDx talk in Hamilton, Ontario, at McMaster's University.
Oh, and how long ago was that?
That was spring of last year. I did three last year. Maybe it was spring of the previous year. I did three last year, number 10, number 11, number 12 last year. So it would have been 2022, spring, okay. I think. When I say spring, it was February. It was cold in Hamilton.
Well, it means you're well-versed in how to relay your story. And I found you on one of the podcast match sites where people go, you know, who have their story to tell. And I was reading your biography on there, and there was a bunch of interesting things, you know, suicide awareness and discussion. It talked about being a writer on the Tonight Show, and then ending up, in darker places. And I thought to myself, that's an interesting dichotomy, because people often don't get an opportunity to understand somebody that brings joy like that to people is suffering until you read about it in the newspaper, right? A Robin Williams type or something like that. And you were able to get yourself the help you needed, that you're able to share the story kind of before it gets too late. And I think that's a really, really necessary story to get out. So, you know, we want to talk about how you got there and all those things. It's interesting to learn about people, but as you say so often in your talks, you say, how do we start this conversation?
Yeah.
So how do we start this conversation today, Frank?
Yeah, that's what most of my clients say to me. Look, we just brought you in here to start the conversation on suicide, because I discovered when I was preparing for my first TEDx talk that even though at the time one person in North America died by suicide every 11 minutes, hardly anybody talked about it unless you brought it up. And then, dear God, everybody's got a story. By the way, it's gotten worse. It's now every 9 minutes in North America, every 40 seconds around the world. And what I tell the audience is, look, my job is just to, well, there's a singing duo, Big and Rich.
Yeah.
And they've got a song, Somebody's Got to Be Unafraid to Lead the Freak Parade. That's my job, is to get on stage, let my freak flag fly and rally my tribe.
Yeah.
And be vulnerable, which most men are, many men have difficulty doing, and sharing my story. And oftentimes I'll say, look, we'll do a little Q&A at the end for everybody. And if you have a story you want to share, or a question you want to ask and don't want to ask in front of everybody, I'll hang out another 45 minutes and take them individually. And I mean, there's two people, five people, 10 people. And they usually start like this. Frank, I've never told anybody this. Yeah, I get that a lot. Because now they feel comfortable to share, knowing I'm not going to judge. I hear the same music they do. I understand where they've been, you know, where they're headed. So it's I think just being willing to start the conversation. Just have somebody come in as a catalyst and say, it's okay to talk about this. As a matter of fact, there's an old wives' tale that if you mention the word suicide in front of somebody who's depressed, it makes them more likely to do it, when in fact it lowers the chances, reduces the risk, if you mention it out loud in front of them.
That's counterintuitive, I guess. So yep. That's why it's the old wives' tale, but it's also probably something that more people, it shouldn't surprise as many people as it does when they hear that. That should be something we talk about a little more.
Yeah, and part of the problem is, let's say you're somewhere in the U.S. and you have thoughts of suicide, and you tell your mental health professional. In many states, they are bound by law to pull you in front of a judge for a hearing to determine whether they should lock you down for 72 hours. So people fearing they're going to be locked down tend to hold back, even with their... I met a guy one time at a comedy gig I was doing, a corporate comedy gig. He followed me to the bathroom because he'd been at my table, and we talked about what I did, and I mentioned the suicide prevention work. And I mentioned that I have chronic suicidal ideation, and they asked, what does that mean? I told everybody. And so he follows me to the bathroom, and he says, I have that. And I said, you have what? He goes, I've got chronic suicidal ideation. I'm 69 years old. I've never told anybody that, not even my psychologist, because he would be locked up. In San Diego, they call it a 5150. That's the code in the law. And he would be locked down for 72 hours if he mentioned that to a mental health professional.
You mentioned in your TED Talks and some of the listening and watching that I've done, that you knew that, you know, depression runs in your family, or you know that now. Obviously, as a younger man, this might not have been quite as obvious, but you probably understood that the way your brain worked, you know, people found your musings, you know, humorous, and you were able to make people laugh and get a reaction that way.
Yeah.
At what point did it kind of, well, I guess at what point did the depression part start to fall into place for you, and how did you come up with the idea to become the mental health comedian and kind of speak about it in a manner that is not quite as heavy and maybe a little bit more welcoming to people?
Well, in addition to depression and suicide running in my family is very funny. So funny is in my DNA. People say to me, do you use the humor as, you know, like, to deal with the depression? No, depression is one thing. My sense of humor is another. I knew in the fourth grade, after I told a joke, kids laughed, teacher was hysterical. I'm going to be a comic.
Yeah.
12th grade talent show. I did stand up. Nobody ever done that before. I won. And then moved to Southern California with the insurance company I was working for. There happened to be a comedy store in San Diego. Still there today. That's where I started. I got on stage, and in my first 5 minutes, I heard a voice inside my head. You're home. So I decided then I was going to go on the road professionally. About 18 months later, I said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 37 years, I'm going on the road to be a comic. You want to come along for the ride? Thinking she'd go, oh, hell no. She goes, yeah. So we gave up the apartment, the jobs, jumped in the car. We were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, 7 years and change. Sadly, I tried to get into Yuck Yucks over and over and over. Never made it into Yuck Yucks, but that's okay. Then the recession hit. I'm sorry. I did club comedy and then some radio and then corporate comedy after dinner, after lunch. And that worked until about 2008, and then the recession hit, and the bottom dropped out of corporate work. And so I rode my credit lines until they ran out in 2010. And that's when we filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. I had a $1 million life insurance policy, and I was going to restore my wife financially by killing myself. As luck would have it, you have to have the policy 2 years or it pays nothing. I'd had it for 22 months. I had to wait 60 days to kill myself. That's why I'm sitting here. Is because if it had been up, you know, 24 months and a day, I probably would have killed myself that day. But as luck would have it, here we are. So when the speaking came back after the recession, meeting planner said, "Frank, we love you. We just can't pay you that kind of money just to be funny anymore. You got to teach our audience something." Well, I had no idea. So a friend of mine wrote a book called The Message of You, Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. She gave me a copy. She goes, "You read it, you'll figure it out." I went into it thinking I got nothing. And then about halfway through, I thought, damn, I do have something. Given my close brush with suicide, my two mental illnesses, more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd, I thought, if I get some training in suicide prevention, I can keynote. Now, the next hurdle was, I've been doing stand-up for 2.5 decades. Who's going to take me seriously? So just by chance, I got an email from a TEDx in Vancouver, BC. And I flew up there to audition. And I got a call from them a couple weeks later. They said, "Look, Robin Williams died by suicide. You're a comic. If you will mention Robin in your TEDx, then we'll book you. You come up and do the TEDx." I said, "Listen, Robin's already in there because I worked with him a couple times." Great. So that's how I got it. My first one was in British Columbia. And that let everybody know that Frank could do something literally deadly serious with humor. I said to the audience, my first joke to the audience was, "You know, I did some research on TED.com, see how other people handle the topic, figuring there'd be a couple of dozen, maybe more, TEDx's on suicide. There were only 3. And then it hit me. Well, duh, if you're really good at suicide, you're not going to be recording a TEDx talk." At which point they realized this is going to be different. So, you know, because there's a psychological principle. if you have to tell somebody something serious, and then you give them a little comic relief, their brain is much better prepared for the next piece of serious business. So it's not just one note: death, dying, mortality, morbidity. You know, it's just these funny anecdotes. A friend of mine came up after a keynote recently, and in my keynote, I said I didn't pull the trigger. And he said, "Man, how come he didn't pull the trigger?" I said, "Man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed?"
Yeah.
That's one of the stories I tell in my, you know, to give them a little comic relief. And it helps destigmatize it. Because when people think of mental illness, oftentimes, they think of the guy on the corner, you know, the homeless person with a sign, "Will work for food." That's like fourth stage mental illness. The system has failed them all the way down the line. They see me on stage, relatively high functioning, funny guy. So it's hard to hold those two images in your brain at the same time. It's, you know, cognitive dissonance. They change how they think people with mental illness look and sound.
Yeah,
you know? And that helps change. That helps lower the stigma.
Well, that was one of the things that I noticed about the way you approach it. You say things like you had an itch in the top of your mouth that you could only scratch with a chrome plated. Yeah, or nickel plated revolver, and and you talked about a guy who was as blunt as a ball peen hammer, and yeah. You know what I it does just give it that little bit of brevity that the conversation doesn't just have those kind of silences that take the air out of the room, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's something that as people start to be able to, you know, maybe they can take that away. They won't have your panache or the way you deliver the line, but they can take it away, and it might not be so hard to talk about the next time, right?
And that's what I'm up to. That's what I'm after. What I tell the audience is, look, 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal are ambivalent. 9 out of 10 give hints in the last week leading up to an attempt, which means you can make a difference. You can save a life, and you can do it by doing something as simple as what we're doing right here, and that is having a conversation if you know how. And I'll teach you how before I leave. So I'm empowering the audience to start that conversation and save lives.
So when you're getting yourself into a situation where you feel comfortable offering that instruction, do you find yourself, or did you find yourself, or maybe you still do, in those conversations where somebody comes up to you and tells you something? You talk about on a cruise ship how a lady told you and sounded like she was a doctor of some variety, the way the story went.
Anesthesiologist.
Right. And do you just, like, do you have to, like, you're not a doctor. You didn't sign a Hippocratic Oath and all these things that you have to maintain a visage of professionalism. You're a stand-up comedian who's got this life experience, and you found a way to marry the two. Do you ever find yourself going, like, pick your job, Frank? You got to listen to this one all the way through and be taken seriously at the end.
Yes. I was speaking on site at a construction company. On site, mostly men. And like I said, I do a little general Q&A, and then I say I want to hang around 30, 45 minutes, take individual questions. So there's half a dozen guys, which is unusual. Most guys didn't want to ask in the general Q&A, but they weren't too shy to line up and ask it privately. Last guy in line, black guy, mid-20s, I'm guessing, and he's crying so hard he can't speak. So I wait, and when he gathers himself, I said, hey, man, what's up? He goes, well, I haven't slept in 2 nights. I work on the 5th floor of this building. I think about jumping off every day. I said, well, why is that? He said, well, in the last year, I've lost 3 people close to me to violence, including my daughter who died in my arms. And the gentleman who's head of human resources was standing not far away, and I waved him over. I said, you need to take this young man by the hand. You go find the EAP, the Employee Assistance Program, binder, and get him to a mental health facility immediately for simply evaluation, because he's circling the drain. All in front of the black guy. And he let the gentleman take him by the hand. And then a couple of months later, I was talking to the meeting planner, dreading asking how'd it turn out. But I finally got my courage up. I said, what about that nice young man? She goes, Frank, he got evaluated, Medicaid, he's back on the job. Oh, almost made me cry.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you probably have those, like, you could tell me a laundry list of those stories.
Yes. People come up crying. You know, what I have is chronic suicidal ideation. And it's rare. And some therapists have no idea what it is. They stare at me like a pig staring at a wristwatch when I say it. And so I'm on stage and I tell a story. I describe to the audience what that is. For me and people in my tribe, the option of suicide always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. And I tell the audience, when I say small, I mean, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had 3 thoughts. 1, get it fixed. 2, buy a new one. 3, I could just kill myself. Well, almost every time I've spoken, at least one person in the audience has that and has no idea it has a name. They think they're just some kind of freak and completely alone. A young woman come up after a college show. She said, thanks for the keynote. I said, you're welcome. She goes, but I got to tell you, it made me weep. How did it make you weep? She goes, you know your story about the car? Get it fixed, buy a new one, kill yourself? I go, yeah. I've been having those thoughts all my life. I didn't know that had a name. I thought I was just some kind of freak and completely alone. And then I heard you say out loud that you have it, and I realized for the first time in my life that I'm not, in fact, alone, and I wept. So that's the ROI.
Yeah. What was that like the first couple of times, you know, you had to bare your soul where maybe you weren't quite as comfortable with opening up as much as you are now, and people hadn't been doing it to you? You hadn't had that ROI. How did you work through that the first part of that portion of your career?
I didn't really have trouble doing it. I was on campus, university, and 2 things happened on campus, University of Montana, Billings. The first one was, we're driving around town, 2 nice young men, students, because it's open to the public as well as college students. So I was doing radio stations promoting it. And one of the students says, you know, Frank, comedians on campus nowadays, they have a rough go. I mean, people get their toe stepped on, you know, they get offended really easily. Are you worried about, you know, being a comedian and doing this presentation? I said, well, if I was doing it as a comic, I'd be very careful. But I'm on campus to save lives. So do you want to know my philosophy about them getting their toes stepped on? They go, yeah. I said, fuck them. Nobody ever died from sore toes. Forgive me if you can't use the F word in the
podcast. That's fine.
Yeah. So and then later that evening, after the event, you know, several people come up, you know, like with chronic suicidal ideation and other things. I'm standing outside the hall where I did the event, and the nice young man's going to get his truck to take me back to the hotel. And it's dusk and it's snowing, and I can hear a river not far away. And so I realize, oh shit, I'm George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown what these people's lives might be like if I weren't simply here to reassure them. And if I killed myself as George Bailey, you know, then I would theoretically take a lot of those people with me who never had a chance to hear me speak.
So when you have thoughts like that, and as you start to put those kind of dots together, it's pretty easy to swing your feet off the side of the bed every morning and put your slippers on and carry on with your day. Like the work you're doing must have incredible meaning to you, right? Like it's very rewarding
and therapeutic. You know, it's one of the reasons I don't kill myself, because I take all those people with me.
Right.
And you know, and I imagine that I help more people than I'll ever know, because not everybody reaches out. Some do. I did a military base in the US, Fort Irwin. And after I was there in October, I got a DM on LinkedIn from the base psychologist. And he said, Frank, a soldier came in this morning. And he said, I'm depressed and suicidal. And Frank King said, if I was, I had to come in. So again, you know, that's the reward. That's my goal, is Gord, is to save a life a day. And you know, long term, I'd like to work myself out of it. I'd like eventually somebody to go, how come you don't speak on suicide prevention anymore? Oh, well, hell, people could quit killing themselves.
But you know, even if I get close, it would be great. And the sad thing is, when I started in 2014, my first TEDx, 39,000 people in North America died by suicide every year. Last year, 2022, it was almost 50,000. And that does not include opioid deaths. That's a whole separate number, over 100,000, because you never know accidental overdose on purpose unless there's a note.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, is how often you revisit those numbers. The numbers that I saw in the TED Talks I watched were 8 million people contemplate, 1 million people attempt, and 39,000 are successful. And you're not talking about, you know, climbing Mount Everest. We're talking about suicide, right? So how often do you go back and revisit those numbers to understand how much worse the problem's getting progressively?
Check every year. Like I said, the last numbers I saw, the last year they had them for was, because 23 has just ended. Last numbers were 22, and it was 49,000 and change suicides in North America. And construction, by the way, has the highest rate of any industry in the North America. And get this, 1,000 people die by accident every year, roughly, in construction. 5,000 die by suicide. You're 5 times more likely to jump off the building than fall off. That's a problem.
That's an incredible stat. That's like that's a soundbite right there for the construction industry, right?
Yeah, that's the one that often gives me the work. You know, it's like, damn. And construction knows, you know, the industry as a whole. I just did an entire 8-hour class simply on construction suicide prevention. That's how much, you know, they're working hard to bring that down.
And are they working with the guys with the hammers in their hands, or who's getting the training on that? Like, is it mature enough as an industry that they're getting you in front of the people, or is it still the middle managers that are trying to understand the problem and the solutions that they can put in front of those people that are in the line of fire?
No, it's the rank and file. When I went to Cincinnati, I did a conference, a suicide prevention conference in Cincinnati. And then two companies in the audience booked me to come in and just do it for them. And both of them sent me out to job sites. So I did it on site to the rank and file. I mean, the middle management's there.
Yeah.
But this is information that that nice young black man, I mean, I'm sure nobody in his crew, nobody he worked with knew he was that close. So that's why they bring me out and speak to the rank and file. And here's a metric for you. I was in New York in January, right before the pandemic. And it was Turner Construction is the biggest construction company in the U.S. And Tishman Speyer is a big developer. And they were building a building called the Spire in Manhattan, 50 stories or something. And they had me do 7 keynotes in 2 days on site. And the meeting planner came up to me after the first one. And he said, Frank, I'm watching them watching you. And after about 10 minutes, not one of them was looking at their phone. And he said, the guy sitting next to me was an iron worker. And I looked over at him as you're finishing up, wrapping up, telling, you know, why you don't kill yourself. And I looked over and I could see one tear just roll down. He wasn't weeping. He wasn't crying, but just a big, gruff, you know, iron worker. He goes, you got to him. And the next morning, because I give up my phone number every time I do it, I go, look, if you're suicidal, call the hotline, 988. If you're having a bad day, just call a crazy person. Here's my cell. And next morning, I got a text, a New York number, didn't recognize. And it simply said, can I get that phone number for help again? So didn't want to ask at Q&A, didn't want to ask individually, but reached out by text. And so I held it up the morning. I said, listen, I got this morning. And I'm getting choked up. I said, they say big boys don't cry. And I said, bullshit.
So what are the, like, you talked a lot about, you know, construction and some of those trades that are dominated by men. What, when you're, but you have talked to and used examples of women who've come to you and in your life, your mother and your great aunts, you know, you talk about that in your TED Talks. What's the split on the demographics that you're seeing and who's more, I'm assuming the women are further along in their ability to reach out for help, but that could be changing, right?
Oddly, 3 times as many women attempt as men.
Is that a fact, hey?
Mm-hmm. Men tend to complete the suicide because they use a firearm.
Right.
Women tend to, you know, perhaps cut themselves or, you know, an attempted overdose. Things that if somebody stumbles upon you, you can be brought back from. But when the gun I had is a Ruger 38, and it was loaded with Federal HydroShock hollow points.
Yeah.
You put that in your mouth, you pull the trigger, you're not coming back.
And I think the 1970s version of that is, you know, Mary's looking for attention because we didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. So she's cutting herself or you know, taking pills or whatever. And I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that's the understanding of that anymore. What is the science behind that or the brain chemistry behind that? Is it just men wait until they're at their breaking point and they do something with such finality, or is there any real reason other than the fact that that's just the way the nature splits them?
Well, it's men in North America, roughly 8 out of 10 suicides every year are men. And many are in the 45 to 54 demographic. A lot of them had previously worked in manufacturing jobs. And people think all the manufacturing jobs went overseas. Well, 15 to 20% went overseas. 80 to 85% jobs were taken by AI and robotics. So if you're a guy and you've been a shop steward in a manufacturing plant making good middle-class wages, and the next morning you're not, men tend to tie their identity to their jobs. You know, and you're 45, 50 years old, you know, reinventing yourself. And, as they say in improv, yes, and, the big boys don't cry. Nowadays they call it toxic masculinity. But when I was growing up in the South, Southern United States, it was big boys don't cry. They don't reach out. You know, whether it's mental things or physical things. I mean, I've had friends die of colon cancer and prostate cancer, and there's no excuse for that. They're both eminently treatable if you have a colonoscopy every now and then and get a blood test for your, you know, prostate, PSA. But men tend to neglect their mental and physical health because they're tough. They're men. We don't need that. Yeah. Colonoscopy, that's an exit, not an entrance.
Yeah, but it's, don't die of embarrassment, right? Go get it done.
Yeah, get it done. It's, you know, I went in the other day to my doctor for my annual, you know, physical, whatever, well visit. And the nurses, the his assistant takes, you know, blood pressure, temperature, you know, weight. And I can't remember what I said to her, something about something I should be doing or am doing. And she said, well, I wish you could convince my husband to take, I may have been talking about the colonoscopy and talking about getting it because I'm due every so many years. Because I wish you could convince my husband to take his blood pressure medication. Well, you know, A, nobody likes a stroke. And B, and I didn't know this till recently, untreated high blood pressure destroys your kidneys. It'll put you on dialysis at some point.
Oh, yeah.
So even if you don't have a stroke, you know, or a heart attack, you may end up going to dialysis every other day for the rest of your short life. So men just, you know, we just seem to be wired. That's why I think somebody getting on stage as a man and being transparent and vulnerable, I think vulnerable is a superpower, especially in a man. Share those stories gives, you know, other people, men especially, the opportunity to give, like the young black man, probably had never told anybody that.
Well, and that's,
he was that close to jumping off the building.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the, and I think it's a cultural thing. I was 42. I lost a job where, when you, you know, it was in the fall of 2020. And before that, for a period of years, 5, 6, 7 years before that, you would have known what my job was before you knew my name, before you knew my wife's name, my kid's name. That's just, that's, you know, that's how it was. And I got kind of done that, and then it was taken from me, or I participated in it for sure. But then I, you know, wanted to start to be a little more introspective and acknowledge some of that. And one of the things I decided to do was start a podcast. I wanted to understand how to have a conversation, a reasonably interesting conversation with somebody that I just met. And that meant doing some, you know, making sure I had notes and doing work and showing genuine interest. And that kind of, and my wife will tell you that I'm certainly not the most introspective and self-aware person in the world, but I'm probably leaps and bounds better than I was. And it comes from having to put myself in these situations. And to your point, if you've been a shop steward at a manufacturing facility for the last 20 years or 15 years, your day-to-day probably looks pretty similar day over day. You know, the same people are coming in and out of your life. And it really allows you to the luxury of not being self-aware and not being introspective and just going about your day. But I'm noticing as I do this, it becomes easier for me to reach out to people. It becomes easier for me to carry on conversations with people that I don't have a lot in common with on the surface.
Right.
And I'm finding that there's so much more value, might not be the right word, but it's just really, at the end of the day, a lot of times I find I'm so fulfilled, more so than I may have been. And it's kind of like when you take a look back and you start putting all those dots together and you go, huh, you know, maybe these people that are telling you that the change, to embrace change and understand, try to understand it and how it affects your life. And I think of you and somebody who's lived a life like you've had and you're having, you must be a fairly, I don't know what the right word is, but like content, like you have these great abilities to have these stories and interactions with people. And not all of them are always the most positive, but they have the potential to be through your work. And that has to be an incredible feeling.
Yes. It gets me out of bed in the morning. It's, you know, it's people that, well, first of all, people ask me, how did you choose suicide as a topic? Well, it picked me. And because it's in my DNA, I don't have to push, you know, it's work. We work long days, but it's rewarding and it's, I don't have to force it. I don't dread getting out of bed in the morning. I look forward to getting out of bed in the morning, and get started. May save a life today. You know, somebody may listen to this podcast who has chronic suicidal ideation and go, shit, that's a thing.
Yeah.
And perhaps that'll change the trajectory of their life. That's why I do a lot of podcasts, because, you know, you reach a lot of people and people share these things. You know, they may hear something that you and I talk about and they go, I need to forward this to Bob. Or they may hear us talk and think, you know, this guy at work, I really come to think of it, I say go with your gut. If you think somebody's struggling, depression or thoughts of suicide, go with your gut and flat out ask them, hey, look, you know, you don't seem yourself depressed. Or if they say they're depressed, then you got to ask them, well, are you having thoughts of suicide? Just like that.
What's your wife's take on all this, having watched this develop throughout the last 20 years of your life? I think I'm loath to call you a performer. You're a speaker, you're an educator, but there is an element of performance to it. And as she's watched this, this kind of, you know, the things that you, the blessing and the curse kind of, you figured out a way. What's her take on all this when something, you know, I don't want to say crazy, but, you know, something unique, the first time Ted called and said, let's talk about this, or the first time somebody said, we're going to put you on a cruise ship for 14 days and we want you to do this. What's her take on all this?
Well, she didn't know that I was depressed and suicidal until I did my first TEDx, and it posted on YouTube. She's about to hit play, and I said, look, before you play that video, there's some things I need to tell you that you don't know about me. We've been married, this is 2014, so we've been married, I don't know, 20 some odd years at that point. And she had an idea that I was a little moody occasionally. I had no idea that I have major depressive disorder and chronic suicidal ideation. And I tell people it's important that your loved one, anybody you know, love, and trust, tell them so they can be there for you. Don't let it be blindsided by this. Don't leave them with, you know, with survivor's guilt. Make sure you let them know what you are facing. So then when it happens, when it, you know, goes to hell in a handbasket, they can be there for you and they know what to do. So, and she got a wicked sense of humor. I have one of my triggers is disappointing her. It'll send me into a spiral. So I do something stupid. I go, you mad? She goes, no, I'm not mad, honey. I'm disappointed. So we can laugh about it. It takes the edge off.
Yeah.
And also, I'll let her know if I'm cycling down, because I don't want her to think, you know, if I look at her sideways, it's something she did. It's just, I'm cycling down. Nothing personal. You didn't do anything. It's just the, you know, my cycle is about 3 days. I go down the first, flatten out the second, come back up the third. So that way she's not blindsided thinking she'd done something wrong. You know, she just knows it's my cycle. I've been through it so many times that, you know, it's, I just know after 72 hours, I'll be flying level again.
So I think what I'm hearing is if you're involved in something like chronic suicidal ideation or depressive episodes, and you're involved in a relationship, it's the communication, the teamwork that are really going to make it tolerable and sustainable for the other person.
Yes, and they can, if they, you know, a lot of people have sort of antiquated views of depression and other mental illnesses. Back in the day, back decades ago, it was kind of like alcoholism. It was a moral failing, a character flaw. And, you know, most people realize it's a chemical thing. It's not something to do with your character. I mean, in some religious communities, if you are stronger in Christ, my next door neighbor, after I came close to killing myself, very religious, he said to me, you know, if you'd killed yourself, you'd have gone to hell. I said, here's what you don't know, Chief. I was already there. So, you know, they're these sort of antiquated. So if your partner or your family members can get educated about the illness, you know, what to say and not say, what to do and not to do, and how to find resources if things go bad. There's a organization in the U.S. called NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness, and they've got a program, 12 weeks for family members of someone who has an issue like schizoaffective disorder or major depressive disorder. The family goes in once a week in the evening and they learn what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do, and how to find resources. And they have family to family counseling. So you meet other families with people in the family who have the same issues. So you don't feel quite so alone. So that's the benefit of sharing with friends and family.
Imagine, speaking of the self-awareness, imagine lacking self-awareness to the point that you find out somebody was attempting suicide and your first reaction is to tell them that they would have gone to hell had they been successful.
I tell people, look, If they believe that, then you can use that line. But I said, don't, when you're talking to somebody, don't layer your philosophy or your religiosity on top of theirs. Meet them where they are. I'm not a big churchgoer.
Yeah.
But if I know somebody is strong in Christ, you know, goes to church every Sunday, Bible study on Wednesdays, I will leverage it. I go, look, what's the deal? Here's the deal. Why don't you and me and your minister get together and form a team and see if we can't tackle this?
Right.
Meet them where they are. Use what you can that they believe to leverage to keep them around.
I want to be respectful of your time, Frank, and I appreciate you. It's been a little. We were juggling things and making sure we could both have enough time, and you came through, and I really appreciate it. But I'm curious, like when you were first getting started on this, and you were trying to figure out a way to talk about, you know, your blessing and your curse,
mm-hmm.
and make it interesting and useful for people, you must have had an idea of success. And now you're clearly very successful at it. And I'm sure your idea of success today is different than it was. Why don't you tell me a little bit about how that's changed?
Well, when I started comedy, you know, it's about telling jokes. Even then, though, eventually I wanted to make a living and a difference. I sold insurance straight out of college, and they used to bring in all kinds of motivational speakers, Zig Ziglar, Brian Tracy, all the old school guys. And I would sit there and think to myself, you know what? I could do that if I just had something to teach people. So for years, I tried to figure out what I had to teach people. And it was finally, you know, the recession and the bankruptcy and coming close to killing myself when I realized, oh, yes, I do. I have something. So that's how I made, but I always wanted to make a difference. And so what it ended up meaning was I had to go from a funny speaker to a speaker who was funny, so that they learn something. They have takeaways. My takeaway from most audiences is, look, you need a self-care plan. I don't care if you're neurotypical or, you know, neurodiverse, because we had a pandemic. I can't believe it's going to be the last one. So you need to be ready. That's what most of my mentally ill friends were well prepared for the pandemic, because we all had self-care plans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody called me and said, I actually had a keynote. I did virtually a keynote called Social Distancing and Staying Sane. Don't worry so much about your mentally ill friends, because we all had self-care plans. And somebody called me up one day and go, man, how are you holding up? You know, I know you got mental illness in the pandemic. And I said, look, dude, here's the deal. I've had 2 aortic valve replacements, a double bypass, a heart attack, 3 stents. I live with 2 mental illnesses, and I lost to a puppet on the original Star Search. This is not the worst thing that's ever happened to me.
The Second Act Podcast would like to thank Ben Sound for the intro and outro music, Happy Rock. We would also like to thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please like, subscribe, and give us any feedback you can. Thanks for listening.